This edition of the Monocle Arts Review was first broadcast on the 30th of April 2015 on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to the Monocle Arts Review with me, Steve Bloomfield. I'm joined today by Arifa Akbar, literary editor of The Independent and I newspapers, to leaf through the pages of some of this week's best book releases. On our bookshelf today, we have Schlump, Hans Herbert Grimm's semi-autobiographical novel, which was banned by the Nazis, but has now been translated into English for the first time. There's also Nobel and Pulitzer Prize-winning author Toni Morrison's new novel, God Help the Child, and we take a look at the effects of well-being in William Davis's The Happiness Industry. That's all to come here on The Arts Review on Monocle 24. So, welcome to the show, Arifa. Let's begin with Schlump by Hans Herbert Grimm, originally published in Germany in 1928. Wasn't particularly successful, wasn't helped by the fact that when the Nazis came to power in 1933, they banned it. So, before we talk about the new translation, why was it initially banned?
Yeah, so, you know, this is a good thing to talk about because there's Hans Herbert Grimm with his fascinating and weird story. And then there's the book, which is strangely brilliant, which I didn't expect. So Hans Herbert Grimm wrote this book, semi-autobiographical, even though, you know, we have a character called Schlump, not Hans. He fought in the Great War. He wrote this as a semi-autobiographical piece of fiction and published in 1928. Bit of a sort of non-response to it. And then in 1933, when the Nazis came into power, they deemed it un-German and banned it and burned it. And luckily for him, he'd published it anonymously. So he then became extremely anxious, joined the Nazi party, or so the story goes, to avoid disclosure, bricked the manuscript into the wall of his house so nobody could discover that it was him who wrote it. And that's that. But the strange ending to this, to his story, is that in 1950, with the Weimar Republic's back now, Nazis are long gone, he had a strange meeting with government and he came out and he committed suicide. And astonishingly, this book's authorship still wasn't discovered until 2013, when they found the manuscript from behind the brick of the wall. So in Germany, they finally found out that this novel belonged to this man, and now we're reading it. You know, first translations in 1928, completely bizarre story, and completely distinct from the book as well. Now the book, I thought, was going to be another war story, and I'm, you know, sort of.
Not a fan.
Well, I've got war story fatigue, to be honest. We've got a lot of stuff coming out on war, you know, Afghanistan, Iraq, all the rest of it. So I thought, oh God, you know, let's brace myself, steel myself for this story. And it's a very, very cleverly written book because we encounter this guy called Schlump, that's his nickname, slightly silly, slightly buffoonish, and the author, Hans Herbert, sort of beguiles us into states of kind of like humour. He uses a lot of humour. Schlump joins the war. He's desperate to make an impact. He's 17 years old. He enlists for war against his parents' better judgment. He's desperate to get out there. He's a bit of a buffoon. He spends the first part of the war sort of chasing skirt. He's, you know, you get lots of silly scenes of him running down the road with chamber pots, you know, in occupied France, rolling in the barn with these pretty French maidens. You know, it's all a bit silly. And there's humour there, but it's picaresque. And I thought, oh, this is odd. Suddenly he's sent to dig trenches and the tone doesn't change, but what you get in this really tight, almost deadpan language is just graphic, almost clinical description of what goes on in the trenches. And it's the language that horrifies you, and there's still an undercurrent of humour, and it is actually truly shocking. And it's got that slightly Sebastian Fox's Birdsong element where man is wreaking horror and just mess and chaos in these trenches. And then you have nature, which is totally impervious. So you have the sky and the birds and the nature and the sunshine. And it's very powerful.
Is there a danger with this book that the story of the book itself, mm. of how the book came to be in our hands today,
yeah.
is actually so fascinating in itself that it slightly overshadows the novel itself?
It certainly overshadowed that. Hans Herbert Grimm's story overshadowed the book when I first picked it up. And I thought, in some ways, the Nazi story is more interesting. This can only be a slight disappointment. Mm. It can only be a sort of slightly earnest description of front, you know, what it's like on the front line. So I was reeling when the book turned out to be good. So I would press this into people's hands saying, you know, be aware of this fascinating authorship and it's sort of unravelling, but don't be fooled. The book's as good. I mean, I've got a shelf in my home with the best books of the year. This is going on the shelf, which is no mean
feat. You have a shelf
I've
just
actually,
of the best books.
It's slightly anal, but you know, I have the best books for 2015. This is going on there. But
okay.
I would just say, just finally would add that it's an anti-war book that I think is really relevant to us. So it's relevant. Well, it's both a historical novel. You see the Great War from Germany's Great War. You see the Second World War and Nazism prefigured. There's a character in there who is all about, he's fanatical. He's all about, you know, German glory, even when they're failing, losing. So there's lots of history tucked away and there's resonance for about, you know, with what's going on today.
Let's move on to the second book, which is, again, perhaps a novel where the story of the author may actually be a little bit more interesting than the novel itself, possibly. This is Toni Morrison with God Help the Child.
Yes.
I guess anything written by Toni Morrison now is going to be, you know, you're going to read it thinking, oh, it's Toni Morrison, and yeah, think about her story before you're actually thinking about the story she's written.
I think you're right. But more than that, I think you're going to think about her, the kudos, the literary prestige, the sort of reverence that comes with an event publication like this. 11th novel, Nobel Prize winner, you know, loved, tracked the African-American experience, you know, across time, across slavery, across civil rights movement. This is publication with a flourish. I hate to think, you know, the fanfare in America will be immense. It's a big deal here too. I love Toni Morrison and I'm a huge fan. So what I'm about to say is sacrilege.
Go on.
You see what Toni Morrison does well here. You see some familiar themes. So you see her describing what it's like to be black in America. You see America's racist past peeping through, or more than peeping through, raising its sort of ugly head more than you'd like. And then you see the relationship between mothers and daughters, which she does so well. So tick, tick, tick there. She's been quite brave in the fact that she's 84 and she's describing what it means to be a young woman. The main character here is a beautiful black woman called Bride. She goes on a journey. She's trying to track down the boyfriend, the lover that's left her with no explanation. She's independent. She's sort of a version of a Beyoncé character. She's drop dead gorgeous. Toni Morrison can't stop telling us how black she is, how midnight black, you know, deadly black, beautiful black. It sort of reminds you of that black pride moment when black became beautiful. So Toni Morrison reminds us of this woman's glamour and beauty. She's independent, she's powerful, she's in the beauty industry. There's also a lot of, it's brave because there's child abuse. One of the major themes is child abuse and paedophilia. So the idea she's exploring is what it means to be a child who's been badly damaged. All those things are new. What I think where it fails is in the new things that she's trying to do. That for every child, there's a predator. There's literally a man in the bushes, a paedophile, you know, lurking in the bushes. It's just so heavy-handed. Instead of giving us story, she falls into quite ranty, you know, polemical outrage about child abuse and paedophilia. And you just double take because this is the much honoured, revered Toni Morrison. You almost can't believe that she's fallen into out of character almost just to sort of give you this preachy.
It's too polemical,
rant.
It's not subtle enough, it's that it doesn't give you anything
subtle.
To think about.
And more than that, this character of this young, gorgeous black woman is so problematic because she's so superficial. So we really don't get a sense of her. She keeps reminding herself of her beauty, quite literally. So she'll talk about her flawless makeup, her flawless hair, beautiful breasts.
Is this part of a problem that the older writers tend to have when they write about young people?
You know,
lots of older writers really struggle to actually put their mind into what a young person is like today.
I would never have said that because I think so many older authors are so brilliant, not just describing young people, just describing the world to us and giving us work. Philip Roth, Margaret Atwood, in their 70s and 80s, some might dispute this, but you know, they're at their peak, they're brilliant. I think this book is just misjudged. I think you're right, the voice of this younger woman sits awkwardly with Toni Morrison. It's almost like she's spliced literary fiction with Sex and the City because of this, you know, Carrie Bradshaw-style voice that comes through.
We're going to have to leave that one there. That's God Help the Child by Toni Morrison. And finally, not a novel, a bit of non-fiction to end with, by William Davis. This is The Happiness Industry, which investigates how well-being influences aspects of our lives. It's published by Verso, who, you know, I have time to a certain extent for Verso, but some of their books are a little bit sort of
bookish,
plodding, left-wing,
academic.
I have something to tell you and I'm going to tell it to you over 400 pages.
Let me ram down some sociology, you know, down your throat. I know what you mean with Verso. So I picked this up thinking, is this really my cup of tea? Do I have the patience for the sort of cross-referencing of philosophy and political theory? And, you know, I was surprised by it. There's a compelling argument. There was lots of things that I'd sort of thought already, but lots of new arguments. Basically, he's a sociologist. He's arguing that the positive thinking industry, well-being industry, has been co-opted by big business and by the state to get us to buy things. He says that, you know, happiness has gone from a pleasurable add-on, an emotion that we all aim for, to something that can be measured, you know, in exact units, and that can be sort of tracked and used as a tool for capitalist gain, basically. And that might sound a little bit Marxist, but it's hugely relevant when he starts applying this theory to our lives. So he tells us at Davos, World Economic Forum last year, they got over a Buddhist monk to talk about mindfulness. You know, this is the world's economic community. These are the leaders of economy. They're having lessons on mindfulness. The government has gotten, the cabinet now has got a nudge unit. You know, this nudge, American nudge theory, where our behaviour has sort of changed for our own good, apparently. For example, we have to opt out of pension schemes. We're already opted in. You know, that didn't used to happen.
Yeah, although, I don't know, some of the stuff that, for example, that we've written about the nudge unit before, and there are some things they do, like, for example, whenever you renew your driver's licence now, you have to answer yes or no to whether you want to be an organ donor. So there are, I feel there are some things.
Checks and balances.
There are some things which are sort of nudging you in a good way, aren't necessarily sort of this sort of
nudge. But you know, on a broader scale, I'm afraid, I'm completely bought by the fact that the nudging, all of it, the tracking of happiness, it has become so corporate. And what it involves, this is the thing that I bought, is surveillance, online surveillance, so that Facebook and Amazon seems to know me better than I do with the titles. I'm very resentful of the fact that it's always suggesting titles that I really secretly wanted.
Facebook knows I like yoga.
How did it know that? Smart homes and smart cities.
But then on this point, Rufa, is he actually saying anything that we don't know already?
I think he's underlining. I think he's not actually. This is not earth-shattering new news. This is really saying we It's crept up on us, but happiness is no longer an innocent emotion. It's there to be manipulated. It's there to, as a form of gain. Neuroscientists, behaviorists, politicians and economists are sort of in cahoots to find the perfect formula. What it reminds me of is Brave New World and the Soma, that it was a sort of medicated happiness, a bit like Prozac, but more effective, you know? You just swallow it. It sort of bans depression and misery out of society. It makes you feel like it's not socially acceptable to be. This is the sort of extremity. This is where we could be heading. And I think misery and sadness is a very important and valid human emotion. Russian literature, all of the 19th century Russian literature tells you it is.
There we are. A good note to end on, if not a happy note to end on. The Happiness Industry by William Davis, out in May, published by Verso. And that is it for today's show. Arifa Akbar, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you.
You've been listening to The Monocle Arts Review with me, Steve Bloomfield. Our producer was Holly Fisher. The researcher was Fernando Augusto Pacheco. Join us again at the same time tomorrow. We'll be talking through a few flicks to see at the cinema this weekend. Do people still say that? I think they still do. Little White Lies, David Jenkins will be our guest. Until then, goodbye from me and thanks for listening.